This podcast includes information provided by the issuer and does not express the views of the interviewer. This podcast may also include forward-looking statements by the issuer that involve certain risks and uncertainties to its business. Because forward-looking statements are subject to risks and uncertainties, the issuer's actual results could differ from those indicated in this podcast. Welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you all so much for the support and for tuning into the Planet Microcap Podcast. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Bobby K. Kraft. That's BobbyKKraft. And you are listening to episode 19. For this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, I spoke with David Wield from Wield & Co. Reg A Plus and equity crowdfunding have been in the news quite a bit recently, especially since the first ever Reg A Plus deal, LEO Motors, got funded and went public on OTC markets. This new alternative financing option did not happen overnight. It's been in the works for quite a while, and although it's still very early, there could be opportunity to invest in exciting new companies using this vehicle. But it was unclear to me how it all works. I thought, who better to explain this topic than the father of the Jobs Act himself, David Wield. The goal for this episode is to learn about Reg A+, equity crowdfunding, how this type of financing is changing the landscape of raising capital for emerging growth companies, and what investors should understand about these types of deals. Thank you again for tuning in to episode 19 of the Planet Microcap Podcast. Please enjoy my interview with David Wield, but first, a word from our sponsor. If you're looking to find the next great microcap idea, join us for the third annual Growth Capital Expo, May 3rd through the 5th, 2016 at Caesars Palace in exciting Las Vegas. You will have the opportunity to meet and network with a who's who from the microcap stock market. The Growth Capital Expo combines education with networking and access to C-level executives. It's easy to register. Just go to growthcapitalexpo.com. See you in Las Vegas. For this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, I have David Wield from Wield & Co. on the program. David, welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast.
Thanks, Bobby. Appreciate it.
Now, thank you for being here. And, you know, we've had David on quite a few times, either doing a video interview or submitting an article to our magazine, the Microcap Review. And I really look to his opinion when it comes to what's going on with the Jobs Act and new regulation. And once he tells you your background, once you hear his background, you'll see why. So, David, let's start there. What is your background?
Well, I ran equity capital markets, which was the whole new issues business of a top 10 underwriter on Wall Street for many years. Got kicked upstairs, ran corporate finance, put in the whole strategy for all the different industry groups, and then ran all of their dot-com businesses globally. I followed my mentor, Wick Simmons, over to NASDAQ, where I was vice chairman of NASDAQ and ran the listings businesses globally for NASDAQ. That's all the listed companies for about 4 years. And then I wasn't happy with some of the market structure changes that were going on that I thought were putting up roadblocks to entrepreneurs and harming access to capital and really the entire U.S. economy. So we started writing about it, and we were able to demonstrate some major structural impediments that had occurred because of changes in regulation, and that all that work essentially inspired the Jobs Act, and that's how I became to be known as the father of the Jobs Act.
Okay, so and the point of today's interview with David, just so everyone knows, is that, you know, there's been a lot of new news, a lot of new information coming out on some regulations that are direct result from the Jobs Act. So I wanted to speak with David specifically about what's been happening. And so on that note, being known as the father of the Jobs Act, for those who may not know, what is the Jobs Act and why is this important?
So we had written some thought leadership pieces that, and were the first effectively to identify that there had been a massive drop-off in small IPOs starting in 1998 during the height of the dot-com bubble. Nobody knew about this. And up until 1997 or 98, about 80% of all IPOs were for sub $50 million initial public offerings, capital raises. And then after 1998, it dropped off to about 20% and it never recovered. And at the same time, you know, we had at the peak of 1997-98, we had about 9,000 publicly listed companies on NASDAQ, the New York Stock Exchange, and the American Stock Exchange, and that number went from 9,000 down to 5,000. And so we think that as a result of market structure changes that dropped the bottom out of the small IPO market and made it harder to take companies public, that it really depressed the entrepreneurial growth economy, and it probably cost the U.S. economy about 10 million jobs. So we made noise about it down in Washington. Washington was just as concerned by the numbers that we presented as we were, and there were six or so congressmen that went out and sponsored different acts and or different bills, and to try and, you know, offer their take on a cure to the capital formation crisis. And those bills ultimately got wrapped up into an omnibus bill, which was named the Jobs Act. So it created the new category of emerging growth company, which was Title I. It created a new form of private placement. You can now generally solicit private placements. That's called 506C. That was Title II. Title III is crowdfunding, which is a little dysfunctional because it's limited to only $1 million. Hopefully at some point we'll be able to relook at that, but the new rules are only going into effect, I think, in the month of May now, finally. And then Title IV, which is Regulation A+, which is, you know, right back to what we had identified as the drop-off in the small IPO, sub $50 million. That's why Regulation A+ essentially allows you to raise up to $50 million in capital. And those were the four sort of major, if you will, you know, pro-capital formation bills that were wrapped together. There's also a bill that now allows you not to have to register publicly until you have 2,000 shareholders. The old cap used to be 500. So it's really healthy for corporate issuers that want to access or go public. Their improvements, it will, it gives you more options. It allows you to have a greater risk mitigation, lower cost up front to access public markets, but it's still not a magic bullet. I think we've got a lot more that needs to be done to really take the level of capital formation up to where it needs to be to support American growth.
Okay, so I wanted to focus on one of those pillars that you mentioned, because it's been getting a lot of news recently, and that's Regulation A+, known as Reg A+, for short. And so I wanted to know what does that mean? You know, how is that a harken back to the late 1990s that you were talking about, and how does this affect investors?
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, it's a title that allows corporate issuers to go public, really to access public investors in sort of a skinny down disclosure document. So the thesis is that it should be less expensive for people to go public. And when it was passed into law, Congress remanded it over to the SEC to actually write the rules. The SEC finally issued the rules, I think it was last year, so that you weren't seeing, even though the Jobs Act was signed into law by President Obama on April 5th of 2012, it really isn't until relatively recently that the rules have been out and that people have actually started to make use of it. There's now, I'm told, about 78 companies that have filed registration statements either under Tier 1 or Tier 2. Tier 1 requires that you file with the states and go through a state regulatory review process. It's only available up to $20 million in capital raised, and it has really hardly any disclosure requirements associated with it. But you do have to go through the gauntlet of the state regulators. So my guess is that that's probably mostly practical only for people that want to do a small offering confined to one or a handful of states, as opposed to, you know, trying to do a broad distribution. We actually know of companies that are, most of the companies that we've been working with are doing Tier 2, what are called Tier 2 Regulation A-plus transactions, and you can do that for any amount of money up to $50 million, but you are going to be subject to higher ongoing disclosure requirements, and but it does give you a state blue sky exemption so that on the offering you can market securities in all 50 states. It doesn't allow you an automatic state blue sky exemption in the aftermarket, and so there's a subset of companies that are, so Elio Motors, which is the first Regulation A Tier 2 transaction that actually went public, is trading in the over-the-counter market. A number of the others are electing to file a what they call an 8A and apply to be listed on NASDAQ, but that's going to then require, or the New York Stock Exchange, that's going to require that they, on an ongoing reporting basis, you know, are essentially fully reporting companies at that point. So the advantage for those companies will have been that they went public and it was less costly to get public, but they're going to start to incur pretty much the same expenses as everybody else that is an emerging growth issuer. And just to make it a little bit more complicated, those companies typically qualify under Title I of the Jobs Act to be an emerging growth company, and they don't have the full-blown reporting requirements of companies that existed prior to the Jobs Act. So, for instance, they don't have to conform immediately with 404B of Sarbanes-Oxley, which is the financial reporting and controls provision. So they save some money. They can go public on only 2 years' worth of audits, so they can save some money. So it's if you will, it's what I call IPO light, and it's very issuer friendly in that regard.
Okay, so you know, a couple things that you mentioned in there is, because my concern is, you know, from an investor standpoint is, and I've talked about it many times on the podcast and many people I've interviewed, you know, it's all about due diligence. It's all about doing your research before you go in and start to make an investment and or feel comfortable making an investment in either a micro cap or an emerging growth company. You know, so what I want to know is, for these Reg A Plus deals, and you mentioned this a little bit, but I was hoping you could elaborate, is how do investors, one, participate in these Reg A Plus deals, and two, on what tier is it most advantageous to do the due diligence? Because it doesn't sound like at either tier there's more or less due diligence done on these companies than the other. Is that, am I off on that, or am I kind of on the right track?
Well, I don't think that investment banks, for instance, you know, brokerage firms are going to be particularly interested for the most part in doing tier one transactions. You know, they tend to be smaller. They're going to be, you know, confined to a narrower, you know, distribution, state, local. I think that, you know, where the banks, the investment banks will get involved is on the larger deals, just because the economics are more attractive. It makes sense to really kick the tires, do due diligence, because investment banks or FINRA-membered firms are, in order to solicit, you know, customers, have to have conducted, you know, due diligence. It's a due diligence defense, and at least if they're, you know, if they're the lead placement agent or they're a lead underwriter. I think that where it becomes murkier is when you're dealing with, you know, crowdfunding portals, and they're not actually making outbound solicitations. I'm not sure how much independent due diligence is necessarily being done. And you know, it's a little bit of a brave new world. It's one of the reasons why I think that that for corporate issuers, you know, trying to bring in capital and convert indications of interest or reservations or whatever you might call it into hard, cold investment dollars, that what we're starting to see is that it's very easy for people online to indicate interest or create a reservation. It's another thing entirely to get those people to actually, you know, open up an account and get their money in to pay for the stock. And so, you know, on the one hand, I think I understand that the ratio of indications of interest on to orders to actual investment dollars on the Elio transaction might have been 4-1, four reservations or indications of interest for every dollar broken in. I think that one so far is the high water mark. I mean, we're hearing others that are less than 10-1 right now. So that's a complicating factor, and the industry is going to have to. This is one of the things that we think about a lot. How do you increase the conversion rates? That's going to be incredibly important to helping more companies be successful accessing Regulation A transactions.
Okay, so on that note, and I do want to take a step back, but real quickly, who right now is converting these indications of interest? Is it the... Yeah, actually, I don't know. You tell me.
Well, that's actually a great question, Bobby. It depends on how you structure the deal, right? And so this is where we're working with corporate issuers quite a bit to help them understand. There's a massive array of ways that people are approaching this market. I mean, Reg A is nothing more than a disclosure document, right? But it doesn't tell you anything about what the mode of distribution or the plan of distribution is. And in some instances, people are doing it direct and using social networking, and the companies are doing it direct. In other areas, they're using investment banks and brokerage firms, and then in some instances they're using both. And so, you know, a deal has to be marketed and sold. Obviously, a big consumer brand, has an advantage sometimes of having a consumer base, and those consumers, because they know the product, may have a higher likelihood of investing if they're approached. And so you're seeing quite a few consumer-oriented or application-oriented companies try and access Regulation A dollars. But you're also seeing some companies that are in the biotech-heavy intellectual property companies, things that are a little bit more conceptual. And those probably really require, you know, getting people on the phone and making the sale, marketing the stocks, communicating with potential investors. It's a much higher touch kind of proposition, and I think that it probably those kinds of companies don't lend themselves very well to portals, right? You need kind of the good old fashioned, you know, retail institutional brokerage model to make those transactions work.
Okay, so as I said, I did want to take a quick step back because we jumped ahead a little bit in, you know, just saying, talking about crowdfunding platforms and what they are. And, you know, can you kind of explain a little bit what they are and their purpose in marketing these Reg A Plus deals? Well, I know it's not just that, but, you know, just in this space right now.
Right, well, you've got... You got a couple of things happening. Most of the deals start out, there is going to be some kind of an online web portal or interface where an investor can come to a website, they can click on a company's thumbnail, if you will. They can indicate interest or reservation, and they can listen to the story. Many of the stories are done in a video format. They can read some verbiage about the company. They can access a link to the offering circular. And if they ultimately want to invest in the company, they can open up an account, transfer money. They'll go through a whole series of diagnostic questions, qualifying questions. Takes a bit of time. They can put their money down and they can buy stock. And the second part is really kind of the portal aspect, because some of these portals have done a pretty fair job of attracting accredited investors to them already, and so they can socialize online a deal with their 17,000 or plus accredited investors. So from a marketing standpoint, you have the investors that are you know, contained within the portal, and then you can also drive more consumers, more potential investors to the website by, for instance, using social networking, email marketing campaigns, keyword searches, anything to kind of increase the visibility to, and drive potential investor interest up. And then, so that's the online area. And again, it's a web interface that allows you to click through and have the deal. A portal may include, you know, already a universe of accredited investors that have already opened up accounts. And then finally, the third element is where you actually have kind of good old-fashioned retail brokerage, where people are able to, actual stockbrokers can call their clients, interest them in a deal. They already have an account open, and they can ticket the stock in that customer's securities account.
Right. And so, because my concern with some of the deals that are on crowdfunding platforms, they may have, you know, 17,000 accredited investors now, you know, in their network, but, you know, it only takes one sour deal to lose those accredited investors. I mean, granted, everybody knows the risk that they're taking to going into these deals, but, you know, for me, what I would be concerned out or worried about is the bad actors taking advantage of Reg A+, you know, especially when you have the crowdfunding platforms out there marketing these deals to investors, saying that their deal pads their criteria, when at the end of the day, you know, they get a cut of the money raised. So what I'm worried about is, you know, why aren't they out there publishing their criteria for due diligence, you know, so that you at least can match up what your investment criteria is with theirs? You know, can you comment on that?
Well, first of all, you know, Bobby, due diligence is, you know, is part art and, you know, and part science. I mean, there are things that you can do that are fairly stock legal, you know, due diligence checklists. And oh, by the way, Regulation A is in the law is not available to so-called bad actors. If you're a convicted felon, you're not allowed to make use of issuing securities off of Regulation A. It's an absolute prohibition of the law. It's actually something that I had inserted into the law. It was a recommendation when I testified in Congress in our written testimony. So they picked that up. They picked up a couple of other recommendations along the way. So, but when you look at diligence, you know, there's really two categories. There's sort of legal due diligence. Is the company properly incorporated? Shares, you know, properly issued? Here's the charter. Here are the bylaws. The company, you know, then there's the company actually exists, you know. So, and then there's the kind of the qualitative due diligence, which is, does the business model make any sense, you know? I'm an expert in the vertical and in the industry, and their business plan is sound, it makes sense. But there's also a third layer, which has nothing to do with due diligence and everything to do with valuation, which is, does the valuation make sense? And I think that, you know, many times in retail markets, which is, you know, and I think Regulation A is, you know, is disproportionately retail at this point, there's not necessarily the discipline of somebody setting an institutional quality price and an institutional quality review as to what the company should be worth. And so I think that there's a risk that people will overpay for these securities in some instances. And so, we are in the very, very early innings of an emergent market. The good news is that, you know, there are going to be a lot of earlier stage, you know, companies that otherwise investors would not have had access to, that would have gone, you know, potentially the venture capital route, that now may access, you know, the public markets, and so investors have a chance to get in on the ground floor. That's the good news. The bad news is that smaller companies are inherently riskier. They fail at much higher rates. You're going to have, I'm sure, quite a number of people on quite a number of deals, maybe even the majority of deals lose money. But you know, that can be made up for if there are some spectacular, you know, winners along the way. And so, you know, it does not absolve people from, you know, doing their homework, and they're going to need to, you know, really take a look at the company stories and do their own due diligence as an investor, you know, really kick the tires. Does it make sense? Read the prospectus, the offering circular, you know, watch the presentation. And if there are conference calls, you know, set up, which there are many instances in webinars, you know, they should use those as an opportunity to dial in and hear the story from management, get a sense of whether or not you think management's qualified to be running the company. At the end of the day, you know, businesses succeed and fail to a large degree on the basis of the quality of the management team.
Mm-hmm. So actually, that really lends into my next question as well, because, you know, in microcaps, you're seeing this as well. I mean, it's been somewhat of a winter for the last couple years, and there's been a real flight to quality. You know, people are really looking for the best deals. They want to put their money in the best deals, the ones that make the most sense, that, you know, all the different reasons why. And so, you know, with that in mind, it almost seems like, well, now that we have this Reg A Plus, you know, everybody's mentality is like, okay, I'm not just going to do this because it's the new next hot thing. You know, I really want to know if there's value here. You know, so I guess another concern would be, you know, is the reluctance for this to take off as fast as we would hope happening, not going as quickly, because people are still a little like, all right, emerging growth companies, microcaps have been kind of in the doghouse a little bit. You know, how do I determine, you know, what deal is, you know, potentially a winner and what is potentially a loser? I mean, obviously it all goes back to due diligence, but, you know, based on what you've been seeing, I mean, what are some of the things that maybe as a value investor, or you're interested in looking at these deals, you know, what should you be looking out for?
Well, you know, there are companies at different stages. Do they have any revenues? So if there are, that's a starting point. And if they have revenues, at least, you know, you can tend to understand that you're not just taking product risk, that they've got a viable product in the market. The question is the revenue significant? You know, looking at the backgrounds, have they been successful in business before or not? I think that's really critical. What's the quality of the management team? Are they adequately funded? You know, is the business in a growth industry? Because the growth will, and growing industries will cover up a lot of evils. You know, but I will tell you that it's very difficult for an individual investor to know with any, and it's even for an institutional investor many times, to do the level of due diligence, particularly in heavy intellectual property companies that you know, that you need to do to kind of assure yourself that you got a fair chance at being successful in the investment. And so there's not an easy answer there. Some businesses are easier to understand than others. You know, I like to say we had a great biotech market, you know, the last couple of years. And in large part, it was driven by the fact that under Title I of the Jobs Act, these were companies that were going through regular S-1s, the traditional registration statement process, that they were allowed to confidentially file and then go out and test the waters and continue to market all the way from the time that they didn't even have a draft of a registration statement, almost essentially straight through the deal. Why is that significant for a biotech company? Well, it's because no institutional investor worth their salt is going to make a $5 million five-year investment on the basis of one 45-minute meeting on an IPO roadshow. And because these are technologically very complicated companies, you have to understand the technology. So what they were able to do by pre-marketing the deals was get crossover sophisticated buyers into the deals that would, you know, and then people would understand that there was somebody that they respected that had done the tire kicking, and they would look to those new investors as sort of proxies for quality. And other sophisticated investors would start to do their homework, but obviously they weren't going to be able to do the deep dive that people had done leading up to the offering. And And as a result, they would sort of piggyback on other people's due diligence. So I think that model, you know, started to work in the biotechnology sector. I suspect that if we can, you know, get more institutional money somehow in as sort of, you know, at quality markers, you'll end up starting to see more retail, you know, basically jump onto their coattails. We're in the very, very early stages of this, you know, regulation A plus market. And, you know, if you go back historically to things like peer-to-peer auction markets, remember at the time of, you know, eBay ultimately emerged from the primordial ooze, there were lots of little auction sites, portals, and the vast majority of them failed or were consolidated out of business, and one of them emerged sort of triumphant. My guess is that you're going to see a lot of entrants proffering, you know, new tools to do investments. There's going to be a lot of experimentation, and ultimately, from the primordial ooze, there are going to be some methodologies and platforms that emerge that are doing a better job than others, and are bringing in that more investments rather than less that are working for investors, and people will begin to sort of jump on the bandwagon, and success will breed success. But yeah, we're in the early experimental innings. It's really exciting what's going on, but there's going to be a lot of mistakes and a lot of blowups, and my guess is that along the way there are going to be some you know, spectacular winners as well, and so I think people kind of have to strap themselves, you know, on for the ride and temper their expectations, because it's not going to be without its growth pains over the next, you know, next 2 to 3 years, be my guess.
Yeah, well, you know, I can't help be overly critical. I just, you know, I want it to be the best that it can be. You know, this is a great tool to help emerging growth companies raise capital and get some exposure out there. And also when it comes to innovation, I mean, you look at Elio, you look at a couple other deals out there. I mean, there's some really cool looking stuff that, you know, now we are being exposed to. So, you know, there's a lot of potential there. And we just, you know, you want to just iron out all the potential downside risk there is, because, you know, that's what's going to both keep investors and attract new ones, you know. And, you know, one last thing too, and I'm kind of taking a quick turn here, but, you know, I've been reading quite a few of these, the circulars going around, and I was just curious, like, how are these deals being priced to investors and then in the aftermarket, and who prices these deals?
Well, you know, they're putting a price on the cover, and they're marketing them at the price. So there's not that, you know, there's not an institutional discipline where somebody, for the most part so far, where somebody's coming in and saying, you know, no, this $10 stock is worth, you know, $7, or it's worth, or, you know, you may actually find in instances where there's oversubscription that people can try and raise the price. I don't know if that's going to occur. I haven't seen any evidence of that. Still early innings. But, you know, most of the deals so far are sort of structured as mini-maxes, and you know, if you break the minimum, they're going to, they offer the price. It's the company that's essentially setting the price with the sponsors, whether the sponsor be a portal, a crowdfunding portal, or it be, you know, an investment bank. So that's the process, and I think over time we're going to have to put, look, you know, there's a couple of things. There's things that we still need to get right in this country. That we don't have a real, you know, viable, strong aftermarket, you know, with a level of aftermarket economic incentives for brokers to provide research and liquidity and really bring in institutional investors. It's something that we're continuing to fight for down in Washington. We actually think that capital formation in the IPO market will really, really come into its own again if there's adequate incentives in the aftermarkets for brokers to provide research, make markets, and get on the phone and tell stories. That's the essential missing ingredient. So I think that until that time comes, you're not going to see institutional quality discipline in this market, in large part because you can't put enough money to work in these deals and trade out of it without market makers being able to commit capital again. So institutions, which are, you know, bigger professional money, are going to be liquidity constrained, and of course, these deals are, you know, by definition under $50 million in size. So, We got a lot of work to do, and we're going to continue to talk about that. I actually have a conversation later this week with the Market Quality Subcommittee of the Equity Market Structure Committee that the SEC set up, the advisory committee that they set up. And so hopefully we're going to continue to educate about what enhancements we need in the markets. And it's one of the great reasons for, engaging and working with Wield & Co. The smarter we get, the more we take that information and we bring it down to Washington, it's really invaluable. So we had an experience recently with a company where they shared their experience, where they were a tier one filer and some of the dysfunction that was associated by that. And I've now got the CEO is going to write up his experience and shoot it to me. We'll probably redact the name, but I'll share it with people down in Washington so that they get a firsthand sense of what's working and what's not working. And that's how we're going to make it better. And I would urge everybody that's listening, that it's all of our responsibilities to, talk to our Congress people and to make sure, because particularly companies, they are job creators, and Congress listens to job creators. The SEC actually listens, write letters, If you've got an invaluable, insight, something happens, give us a call, we don't bite. We're out there. We're fierce advocates for, improving entrepreneurial access to capital. We passionately want it to work. And I think that we've been, with the support of many other evangelists, have been really moving the boulder up the hill very, very steadily. And I think that the key thing is for everybody to do their bit and not to stop, as if we keep pushing it up, we'll be someplace, 3, 4, 5 years down the road where we're leading a resurgence in job growth and economic vitality in the United States that I think we all understand we so desperately need. I mean, if you look at the economy, the fact is that the median wage in this country has declined over the last 15 years. And we think that a lot of that has to do with the fact that the numbers of startups, the percentage of startups in this country, probably because of the collapse in these IPO markets and the lack of access to capital, the number of startups has steadily declined as a percentage of total companies in the United States. So we need to get those numbers, going up again. And in the process of doing that, I think we have the potential to unleash an economic revolution, an economic vitality that everybody can be proud of. There's a multiplier effect. Companies raise money, they spend money in the economy, they generate. I think there's Professor Enrico Moretti at the University of California, Berkeley, said that for every technology job that's created in an economy, there's up to 5 service sector jobs. There is a multiplier effect. And so, if we can do this stuff on scale, we can really move the needle. We can get median wage labor rates to start to increase again. We can improve opportunity for the next generation. These are the things that I think are must-haves. And so, anybody that is listening to this, I think, that your job is to make sure that you make a contribution to continuing to move that boulder up the hill to get us back to where we ultimately need to be. It's about leaving a legacy that supports the reinvigoration of the American dream, that gives it back to the American people on the scale that we can all be proud.
I'm voting David Wheel 2016. All right, David, you're going to be one of our keynote speakers actually at our upcoming conference, the Growth Capital Expo in Vegas, May 3rd through the 5th at Caesars Palace in Las Vegas. All right, what are you speaking about at our event?
Well, we're going to talk about the transaction. I'm going to be on a couple of panels. I'm going to be keynoting and talking about sort of the changes that are going on down in Washington, some of the legislation that's been proposed, because there's a steady pipeline of changes. And we've got from everything from there's a venture exchange act called the Main Street Growth Act that passed the House Financial Services Committee. There's a Small Company Advocate Act that They're proposing to put somebody within the SEC to advocate on behalf of small companies. And so, you know, if you will, we continue to chip away. Some of these are sort of institutional changes so that we can then, you know, create a self-sustaining discipline in improving capital formation for smaller companies. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll get updated ourselves as to where that stuff stands. Of course, it's an election year. It's a presidential election year. And my guess is that not a lot is going to get done, you know, this year while the campaigns are going on, and that we'll seat a new Congress and we'll have to reload and see where we go from there. And so maybe 2017 will be, you know, the year where we make some real legislative gains. But, you know, as I said, it takes everybody staying involved and keeping these questions and concerns and ideas alive in the minds of people in the House of Representatives and the minds of the House Financial Services Committee in particular, because they introduce legislation, the Senate Banking Committee, which is their counterpart in the Senate, and then over at the SEC.
Okay, so David, where can our audience go and find more information about you and Wield & Co.?
Wieldco.com. It's pretty simple. And you know, I'm pretty easy to reach. My email is david.wield, W-E-I-L-D, at wieldco.com.
David, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
You too, Bobby. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you all for tuning into the Planet Microcap podcast, and thank you, David, again for coming on to the program. You can access the podcast by going on to stocknewsnow.com under podcast. Go to podbean.com and search Planet Microcap Podcast, or on iTunes and search Planet Microcap Podcast. Stay tuned for the next Planet Microcap Podcast, where we'll have our next guest to discuss all things microcap. If you have any questions or comments about the podcast, please send an email to info@stocknewsnow.com. I'd love to hear from all of you. This podcast has been brought to you by SNN Incorporated, publishers of StockNewsNow.com, the official microcap news source, and the Microcap Review magazine. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you again for joining me on the Planet Microcap podcast. See you in Las Vegas.